rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Flory, Judge Cochran. The Honorable Louise Dovre Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on a blustery spring day, April 11th, 2019. The first case on the calendar for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus William, I think it's Chevrolet. Close enough? All right, we'll go with Chevrolet. You're both familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for argument. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please state your name, identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, and it looks like you're already raising or lowering the podium. You know that as well. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent appellant State of Minnesota in this matter. This case presents two straightforward legal questions. First, did Mr. Chevrolet's motion to suppress toll the UMDDA's 180-day time limit? And second, if it did toll the time limit, how long did it toll the time limit for? That is, when did tolling start, and when did tolling stop? On the first issue, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have recognized, and this is on page one of my reply brief, that the UMDDA can be tolled when the defendant caused or created the delay, and that the delay can be, quote, caused by a variety of actions by the defendant, unquote. Now, Mr. Chevrolet concedes that a motion to dismiss tolls the time limit. His argument is that this court should hold that it is only a motion to dismiss that can toll the time limit, and I have two responses to that. First, this was a motion to dismiss in all but title. His motion to suppress asked for suppression of the only two people who gave statements, the two women who said Mr. Chevrolet was the person who pointed a gun at us and threatened us. There were no other statements, and when Mr. Chevrolet was caught, he did not have a gun on his person. So, without these statements, there's no evidence against Mr. Chevrolet. The state would have had to dismiss the case. So Mr. Chevrolet's argument is essentially...
Didn't the court have 6 months to schedule that hearing, Mr. Raggett? I mean, I think your argument would be stronger, quite frankly, if they had filed the motion to suppress the last week in February. But, I mean, they filed it in the middle of October at the very beginning of the 180-day period. It seems, quite frankly, a little inconceivable to me that they wouldn't have, that there wasn't time to have that suppression hearing.
Your Honor, that goes to the issue of how long the tolling should occur. If there was no tolling, then that's irrelevant. And Mr. Chevrolet is arguing that you don't even need to reach any timing issues because there was no tolling here. So my first argument, which is necessary to the second argument, is that there should at least be some tolling here. When you file a motion to suppress, the hearing can't be that day. The decision can't be that day. There has to be some delay.
So is it really in your argument, is the fact that a defendant has asked for the court to do something other than move immediately to trial, that is what so it really doesn't matter what they've asked the court to do, but they've asked the court to do something other than try the case that effectuates the tolling?
That's one of my two arguments here. My two arguments on the tolling issue are, first, this was a motion to dismiss and everything but name, so you don't need to reach the issue of what other sort of motions might toll. My second argument, though, is what you just said, that a motion that causes a delay tolls under the case law. Now, if it's a motion for admission of Spriegel evidence, maybe not, because that doesn't have to be decided until during the trial. But anything that's going to delay the trial, as this necessarily would have, tolls under Minnesota case law. But again,
well, if we are to agree with you that the time is tolled for delay caused by the defendant, how do we distinguish between the delay that's caused by the defendant versus the delay that's caused by the district court itself? And in this case, there was a delay in issuing the order on the motion to suppress even after the briefs were filed that was fairly substantial.
That's correct, Your Honor. So if you agree with me that there was at least some period of tolling here, then the second issue is how long. You don't need to reach that issue if there was no tolling. But if there was tolling here, Mr. Chevrolet's argument is that 201 days went by, which is 21 days after the time limit. That's set out in his brief. And his argument is that the only tolling that occurred here was from the date of the hearing through the 30 days allowed for the decision. So he attributes correctly 61 days to that, and that everything else is not tolled.
What about the briefing period?
Well, that's in the 61 days. He says you have the hearing, then you have the briefing period after the hearing, then you have the 30 days to decide. That's 61 days. He agrees that is tolled. But he says if you don't toll the whole rest of the time, then you have 201 days, which is 21 days over. So to find that you did have this 21 days over, you have to find two things. First, that the tolling period didn't start until the hearing, and second, that the tolling period stopped after the 30 days to decide the issue was up. If you reject either of those arguments, then we're not 21 days over anymore, and we're within the 180 days. So my first argument is that no case law supports the notion that tolling only starts with a hearing. It doesn't start with the motion itself. That would be new law you'd be creating here. At a minimum, there must be tolling for the 28 days that Mr. Chevry acknowledges is allowed for scheduling a hearing. Again, the hearing couldn't have been that same day the motion was filed. And he agrees that you toll for the 30 days allowed for the decision. So why then wouldn't you also toll for the 28 days allowed for the hearing? They're analogous. And if you take away those 28 days, we're no longer 21 days over the limit. So that's all you'd have to find here to find no UMDDA violation here, is that at a minimum, there is tolling for the 28 days allowed, and that's on page 11 of his brief, for the hearing. So that's one thing you'd have to find. The other thing you'd have to find here for a violation is that the Rule 1107 30 days ends the tolling. And again, that would be making new law. There is no law that says that once 30 days is up, tolling stops. I mean, there's no remedy for that 30 days.
Does the court have jurisdiction after the 30 days to rule on the motion?
Yes, it does. The case law states that the remedy for a 30-day violation is not the motion automatically has to be granted. There's a speedy trial remedy here if judges delay things too much. And I think that's an important point here, is that remedy still exists for Mr. Chevry. He made a speedy trial complaint below, but the judge didn't rule on it because the judge found this UMDDA violation. So if this court finds no UMDDA violation because there was tolling and because at least the 28 days applies, so there was no 21-day violation here, or there was no 21 days over here, it would go back for the district court to rule on the speedy trial claim, which is where the court could consider prejudice, how strongly Mr. Chevry pushed his speedy trial rights, all of the usual factors here. So there is a remedy here if this court feels the judge was derelict in his duties. But the remedy is not to create new law on tolling and endorse this creative accounting as to when tolling starts and stops. And the remedy is not to limit UMDDA tolling to only dispositive motions that are called dispositive motions. Again, under KERS, a variety of defendant actions can toll, and this is one of those actions that should be held to toll, again, because it was essentially a dispositive motion, and because it falls generally within the category of defense cause delay that leads to tolling. So, again, if you agree with me on the, if you don't agree with me on the tolling issue, you don't need to reach the timing issue, and I think the timing issue is the harder issue here, but
What about the issue? There's some reference in the record that the court actually had the case set for trial in December, which would have been within the 60-day speedy trial demand, and it was Mr. Chevry and his counsel who asked for a continuance of that trial date. Where does that factor in?
I think that certainly factors into any sort of speedy trial analysis. The UMDDA says a judge has to find good cause within the 180 days to go beyond it, unless there's tolling. And I agree that there was no finding of good cause within the 180 days, so that just leaves us with tolling here. And the tolling here occurred with the suppression motion, and again, at least with the 28 days to schedule the hearing. I think you are correct, though, that it is not a situation here where the judge completely was asleep at the wheel and just there's nothing anybody could do. Mr. Chevry was assigned a new public defender on February 21st of 2018. Presumably that caused some delay. The record here isn't fully fleshed out on all the reasons for the delay because that goes, again, more to a speedy trial issue, which still has to be ruled on, and less to whether there was a tolling under the UMDDA issue, which is all the judge decided. and which is what we're here on right now.
But why wouldn't a request to continue the trial day be trial date be factored in on whether or not Mr. Chevry here caused the delay in the scheduling of the matter within the 180-day time period?
I think it could be, Your Honor. I think that that could also be a tolling situation here. That's not an argument that has been fleshed out in terms of the record for the, all the reasons for the delay, and it's not one you need to reach, frankly, given the suppression motion. But I think that does factor into the delay here and the defense cause delay here.
Counsel, in the judge's order, the judge notes that the state at the March 29th, 2018 hearing, the state did not ask the court to address the issue of whether the motion to suppress constituted good cause to extend the 180-day expiration date. Is that problematic in terms of your argument? Is there an obligation of the state to raise that issue with the district court?
There isn't, Your Honor, not under the case law. And we're not arguing there was good cause here. We're just arguing tolling. Now, obviously, in retrospect, it would have been a good idea for the prosecutor to have asked for this good cause finding in sort of a belt and suspenders kind of way. You know, you've got the tolling and the good cause. But given the tolling, the prosecutor did not have to seek a finding of good cause because there had already been a tolling of the 180 days under the case law. And I think it is important to note here that Mr. Chevry never said, hey, Judge, the 100 days is going to be up soon. Could you please expedite things? He never asked for an expedited scheduling of the hearing. He never asked for expedited ruling on his motion. He sort of just sat on his hands and then when the 180 days were up, said, gotta let me go now. And under a speedy trial analysis, that's relevant. And it should also be relevant under sort of a fairness of tolling argument or in notions of justice in terms of when tolling starts and stops argument. It doesn't technically apply to a UMDDA argument as to good cause because there was no good cause finding here. But again, the issue here is A, is there tolling, and B, how long is the tolling for? And Mr. Chevry's argument as well, it offends the notion of justice for tolling to occur over this whole time period. And if we're thinking about justice, we should also be thinking about A, the lack of prejudice ever asserted, and B, the fact that Mr. Chevry never said, hey, please expedite things here, Judge, our time is running out. Mr. Chevry has also argued that it's not fair to make him choose between the 180-day deadline and filing a motion, but you have to choose when you file a motion to dismiss. He's acknowledged that, and again, this was, in everything but name, a motion to dismiss. The state would have had no evidence left if his suppression motion had been granted. And for that point, I'd refer this court to the defense motion to suppress and the district court's ruling on that, which sets out the facts here, which include the fact that there were no other statements and there's no indication that a gun was found on his person or there was any other evidence the state could have relied on. So in light of those points, I'd ask this court to send this back to the district court to consider the speedy trial issue, but not to make new law on tolling being narrowly limited to motions that have the word dismiss in them and not create new law that tolling only starts with a hearing and stops with a time limit set out by the rules. And unless this court has additional questions, I'll be back for a rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bryce Norton. I represent the respondent in this matter, Mr. William Chevry, Jr. Of course, the court is aware this is a matter involving the Uniform Mandatory Disposition of Detainers Act, and we'd be asking the respondent, is requesting that the court affirm the district court's decision to dismiss the case because that court correctly determined that having failed to schedule trial or find good cause prior to the 180-day requirement under the UMDDA, it no longer had jurisdiction. I'd like to point out that the court order appealed here found that the UMDDA time limit can be told when it is caused and created by the defendant. I would definitely agree with that. Such a motion could be like a filing to dismiss. That's something that is definitely in the case law. Filing to dismiss is something that would toll the actions. There isn't any case law out there that would say that a filing in any other way would toll the proceedings. The trial court found that the respondent did not file a motion to dismiss. They also found that the respondent did not request or agree to any continuances of his case to a date after the UMDDA expiration. Now, I know Justice...
He could have had a trial in December, though, counsel. I mean, they had it scheduled, and he and his counsel asked for it to be continued. So we wouldn't be here if he hadn't made that request.
That is correct, Judge, and I that's what I was just going to get into, based on your question to appellant attorney. That hearing took place November 20th. The trial was set to happen December 11th. One of the issues that they were having is, first of all, they had made their motion for suppression a month before that. In October, I believe it was 18th that they made that motion. That still had not been heard. Now, we're on the eve of trial within 21 days here, or about 21 days there, and they still haven't heard that motion. We know that we're going to have to hear that before trial starts. Not only that, Mr. Chevrier was having issues based on that... that hearing, Mr. Chevrier was having issues with transporting back and forth from the DOC commitment there, and it was affecting things that he could do by still having him on bail at that point. So that was one of the requests, is that he just be released from his bail on that, and that it could be move on to the next trial term.
So the speedy trial demand under the Minnesota rules, he basically waived because he was already in custody on something else. Is that correct? That's how I understand the record, although the 180 days, according to you, would continue to march along.
Well, yes, and it's hard to argue against that. I mean, he agreed to go past the 60 days. Once they said it was, he said the next trial term, and that often happens, they'll go to the next trial term.
Then wasn't there additional delay because the parties were engaged in negotiations about how to resolve the case? I mean, as I understand the record, things moved ahead with the defendant's acquiescence. I mean, the fact that it was not until March that the motion to suppress was actually heard and then fully briefed another, period of time later, your client was part of that ongoing delay.
And based on that hearing that happened on November 20th, it would be impossible to argue against that. That is correct, that he did waive that trial date that was happening for December 11th.
So how does it make sense to continue to, how does it make any sense not to toll the 180 days, given the fact that your client has been either directly asking for or agreeing to delay?
He didn't agree to anything past the UMDDA. I mean, the January 5th hearing that they got, it's the next term. That's some 4 months prior to the 180-day requirement. So he's still within that amount of time during that period. There were still things that needed to be addressed, and as you said, there were still negotiations going on as far as the court went. I believe as far as the transcript goes, defense counsel did bring up that they brought up a possible settlement to the prosecutor, and that was rejected by them, and that was part of why they were still moving forward with that. There's still no explanation as to why the court had this the UMDDA request in front of them, as well as a speedy trial demand in front of them, and they did nothing to set a hearing as far as a suppression hearing for the motion from the defense prior to that time. So our first argument, as appellant did bring up, is that there shouldn't be any tolling at all based on the fact that it was not a motion for a dismissal, and there's no case law on that states that there would be tolling with anything less than dismissal. If this court is to find that there is tolling, it's important to note that in the Kurtz case, this limit on the tolling is to toll by the time reasonably needed to consider the defendant's motion. And a similar language was used in Wilson as well, that the matter should have been told until that particular issue brought before the court by the defendant could be determined. Now, we've had some discussion of what happened, and to go over the specific dates, that the court's aware of all the dates, but this original UMDDA demand was made on October 16, 2017, and the motion to dismiss was made on July 5, 2018. 262 days after the original motion, which is 82 days over the 180-day limit. It's also important to note, as the court has brought up multiple times, that this was 5+ months since the date of the motion to suppress until that motion was heard in front of the court. on March 29th.
Well, and then at the defendant's request, the motion was left open for another month, right? Because didn't defense counsel ask to be able to submit written argument after the March 29th our suppression hearing?
Yes, and appellate counsel brought that up, and in our brief we did admit that if there's going to be any kind of tolling based on this, that time from March 29th until the submission on April 27th, yes, that would be part of the tolling period. And not only that, under the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, 11.07, it does state that the omnibus issue should be resolved within 30 days. Now, appellant wants...
Why shouldn't that be an additional period of tolling then, from October 16th or 18th when the motion was filed?
From October 16th all the way till March 29th?
No, till it could be reasonably be scheduled. It couldn't be scheduled within 28 days, or it had to be scheduled within 28 days, say. So why wouldn't that be? I mean, Mr. Raggett says, you know, that alone will resolve these issues, because if you follow the rule and say a reasonable time is sometime around 28 days after the motion's filed, then we're back within the 180-day time frame anyway.
And I understand that. I was talking about the, I apologize, I was talking about the 30 days to come up with a ruling after the omnibus issues are heard. But yeah, okay, so as far as that issue goes, we are still under the, at that point, we're still under the, not only the state speedy demand of the 60 days, but also under the 180 days UMDDA. It's not hard for, and it oftentimes happens for courts to schedule it a lot earlier than that 28 days, knowing that they're under the gun there. So it just doesn't have, this is reasonably needed to consider the defendant's motion here. That's what we're talking about as far as tolling goes on this. Now, not only did that, it just didn't happen during that amount of time, and I don't think that time was reasonably needed. It wasn't that complex of an issue that they needed to wait all the way out for that 28 days when the court knows that it needs to have this done, that the defendant has made their argument here. As far as the tolling following the March 29th hearing and the submissions, the appellant would argue that that it's... setting a new standard to say that 30-day limit would somehow limit tolling periods. But again, going back to what Kurt says, it's the time that's reasonably needed to consider the defendant's motion. The Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure have decided that 30 days is a good amount of time that a court should have to consider omnibus issues. Now, it would be good to relate that, to say that's probably a reasonable standard, a reasonable amount of time, especially when you know he's not only made a speedy demand, but he's got the the speedy demand originally under the 60 days, but the UMDDA demand as well. So even if you put both of those tolling periods, added that to the tolling period, take that down from the 262, it still leaves us with the 22 days over the 180-day limit. Now, it's important to know...
If we disagree with your argument that tolling only applies to motions, a defense motion to dismiss, if we take a different position, is the timeliness or jurisdiction something we can decide, or would you argue that a remand would be necessary for the district court to make findings as to tolling?
Well, I believe that the standard would be that you can review that issue de novo on this, the jurisdiction issue, whether they retain jurisdiction on that. Now, it's important to note that there is nothing in the record to indicate that the respondent caused delays other than what we talked about with possibly moving out the trial date from December 11th at that November 20th date. And there were no continuances requested on his part, again, other than that we talked about. Now, I wanted to press briefly on one in an appellant's brief. He does state that this is kind of the respondent saying, gotcha here. I'm just kind of waiting and waiting for you to miss your time limit. Oh, I got you. Now you got to dismiss it. But that's not the case here. The state and the court were on full notice of the UMDDA demand. The court was obligated to honor the timeline. The defense was under no obligation to continually warn of the UMDDA demand, and nor should they be. Under Hamilton, it was one of the cases stated in our brief, the UMDDA was a legislative intent to go beyond the minimum standards and provide a specific mechanism for an inmate to assert his right to a speedy trial. That was done here. a general rule that inmates should be brought to trial within 6 months. That was not done here, and that is not at issue as to whether that was done here. And a definite consequences for a consequence for undue delay, dismissal of the charge irrespective of its gravity. So it's not the defense's obligation to continually tell him. He did. He told him, this is what I want, the UMDD. I want this done within 180 days.
I think that would be a more persuasive argument, counsel, had Mr. Chevry not asked for a continuance of the trial date. I think, wasn't it fair to assume at that point that for the court, even the trial court, even to say, all right, you know, we tried to comply with your request, but you've requested a trial date to be continued, and so I've granted your request. And they didn't hear from him again after that. So I think that argument is stronger if he would have demanded the 180-day time period when he filed it and nothing happened in between. But he actually engaged in some affirmative action to delay the matter. So I don't know how we don't factor that in.
I agree with you, and I agree that he did waive the 60-day period. And that's where it gets a little wishy-washy, I guess, as far as two different time periods that we're looking at here. So we have that general 60-day period when you're sitting in custody in maybe the county jail, and then you've got the 180-day when you're a prisoner of the DOC. He did not agree to anything anywhere near the UMDDA limit. He agreed to the next term. And you're right, it would have been a better argument had he said, I still am maintaining my UMDDA 180 days with this, but I'm waiving my 60-day speedy trial demand. So that's all he waived, though, at that point. That's the only thing that happened there. He moved on from that. But I agree you're completely right. It would have been better for him, and our argument would be more persuasive had he at that point said, I don't waive my UMDDA demand with my waiver of the 60-day speedy trial demand with this.
Counsel, did you have anything else to add to that? I have a different issue I'd like to
ask you about. No, that's fine.
Appellant argues that the motion to suppress in this case is essentially equivalent to a motion to dismiss for purposes of tolling, because if the motion had been granted, the state would likely not have proceeded. And it doesn't appear that you disputed that in your brief. Could you briefly address that argument?
Well, and the difference, I guess, in that is that when you get the motion to dismiss, there's no reason to continue on with the trial date and setting an additional date and assuming that anything else is going to happen. This motion is definitely going to be dispositive. It's going to figure out what is going to happen with this case. When you get the motion to suppress, they could still have set a trial date out. They could have set this briefing schedule out. I'm going to have my order done by this amount of time, and here's where the trial date is. It doesn't stop the court from going forward with scheduling. But
isn't that true with the motion to dismiss too? Whether you're talking about a criminal case or a civil case, I mean, there's no guarantee that motion's going to be granted. I mean, isn't a trial date still looming even if there's a motion?
That's true, but generally, with the dispositive motion, it doesn't happen in the same fashion with the non-dispositive motion. It's a lot easier to schedule it out that way. Just one thing branching off before to done here. The Miller does state that UMDDA exists for no other reason than to establish the prisoner's rights to a speedy disposition of untried charges. Permitting prosecution outside the UMDDA denigrates a clear and workable statute that sets out a reasonable period of time and a simple and fair procedure to protect a defendant's right to a speedy trial. And that's what happened here. We had a UMDDA demand with plenty of time to accomplish, and the court failed to honor the statute of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Rebuttal is a little outside of my normal practice, so forgive me if this is a bit scattershot. I wanted to start by just clarifying one thing in the record. This came up in our mock argument. Why does the UMDDA even apply here? Well, it applies here because appellant was in prison on a robbery conviction. And if you look at the Department of Corrections website under his last name, he was released from that conviction on January 30th of 2019. That's one reason there was no prejudice here, because he was in prison regardless of when this trial occurred. It's also interesting to note on the Department of Corrections website that he's a wanted fugitive as of April 4th of this year. So apparently he's fled probation. But that's why the UMDDA applies here. And that is perhaps why appellant Mr. Chevry never made any request to expedite things here. And Mr. Chevry says, well, this isn't a gotcha situation. He didn't have any obligation to remind the court. But if you're looking at a speedy trial analysis, if you just make a speedy trial demand and then sort of pretend it never happened and hope the deadline gets blown, that factors into the analysis. And it should factor into the analysis here, too, because if Mr. Chevry was really missing out on prison programming or there was some real problem from the delay here, he could have made a note of the prejudice and he could have reminded the court of the need to expedite things. He has never made any claim here that the prosecution delayed anything here. This wasn't a case where the prosecution said, oh, my witness is on vacation, you got to reschedule. I'm on vacation, you need to reschedule. This is not a situation where the prosecution caused the delay. And the case law recognizes that it is absurd to punish victims and society by letting an accused walk free with no hearing, no trial, no nothing, just because of a delay caused by the judge. And that's what we have here, is a delay caused by the defendant, and at worst, a delay caused by the judge, not the prosecution. Now, appellant's argument here is that you should hold that tolling only occurs with motions to dismiss. But Kurz says that tolling can be caused by a variety of actions. So you'd be rewriting Kurz to say it's not a variety, it's one. Tolling can only happen when there's a motion to dismiss. So that's a problem with that narrow argument. And again, this was essentially a motion to dismiss. It would lead to gamesmanship if you had to include the words to dismiss in your motion for there to be tolling. I mean, why would you ever do that? You could just move to have the gun or the drugs or whatever, all the evidence suppressed, and then as soon as it's granted, say, hey, lack of probable cause, you have to dismiss. But those things went hand in hand here. Mr. Chevry hasn't disputed the fact that this would have thrown out all of the state's evidence. So it was, in anything but a formalistic way, a motion to dismiss. We've talked a little bit about the 28 days and how if you add the 28 days for scheduling the hearing back in, there's no UMDDA violation here. Appellant says, well, or Mr. Chevry says, well, it could have been scheduled before the 28 days, but witnesses have to be scheduled. It's not that simple. And you could say the same thing about the 30 days. He agrees the 30 days to decide doesn't count. Well, a judge could certainly decide within less than 30 days. So if you're going to give the judge the full 30 days, you should give the parties the full 28 days, too. And again, that defeats any problem here, given Mr. Chevry's argument that there was only a 21-day violation. And looking over my notes, I think that's all I wanted to add. Unless there are additional questions, I'll simply ask that you reverse and send it back to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period.